building. Then, keying the hollow on her desk, she punched in a familiar number. The display lit up with a triangular face, bright eyes, and lumpy head crest of a female Anx.
"Hello, Echoes,"
Arinda said.
"This is Arinda Price. How have you been?"
For a moment, the eyes goggled. Then, abruptly, the Anx mining boss let loose a stream of Shusugaunt.
"Easy, Echoes, easy,"
Arinda said.
"Basic, if you please. My Shusugaunt is quite rusty. Yes, I'm back. And yes, I'm still governor. But that doesn't mean we can't still work together. If you're still in the business of making money, that is."
"Of course,"
Echoes said, the words barely understandable through her thick accent.
"Good,"
Arinda said.
"You're aware, of course, that Price Mining had a vein of Dunium they were working. I presume you're also aware that the vein has played out."
"Yes, to both,"
Echo said, her voice heavy with regret.
"It is very sad."
"Not really, since we both know it isn't true,"
Arinda said calmly.
"I saw the report, and I know that the granite block that supposedly marked the end of the vein is nothing more than an intrusion. The Dunium continues on the other side."
"Really?"
Echo said, sounding surprised.
"Are you sure?"
"Of course I'm sure,"
Arinda said.
"Because you've been mining it."
The wrinkled cheeks puckered with dismay.
"Governor Price!"
"Don't bother denying it,"
Arinda interrupted.
"Because I've seen your numbers, too. The reason I called was to tell you that I've just shut down Price Mining. That means that starting tomorrow morning, you can go full bore on that vein without worrying that one of Ranking Stooges will hear your machines behind the granite."
The cheeks puckered again, this time in the opposite direction.
"I do not know what to say."
"Then don't say anything,"
Arinda said.
"Just get that Dunium out and into processing."
She looked briefly at the map she'd pulled up on her datapad.
"Depending on where the vein goes, we might need to relocate another farmer or two to get it out. Let me know if you need me to do that."
"Yes, Governor Price. May you rest tonight in the warmth of your dreams."
"And may you,"
Arinda said. She keyed off. The sheer low-mind commonness of the traditional farewell grating across her ears and mind. She'd always thought Lothal painfully rustic, but life on Coruscant had seriously sharpened the contrast. She turned back to her computer
and paused. Through the west-facing window, the sun was beginning to set. For a moment she watched, thinking back to the evening when her mother was arrested, and their lives had changed forever.
At the time, she'd thought how the people in big cities probably never saw the horizon or the sunset, and had wondered if they ever thought about such things,
or whether they even cared.
Arinda had lived on Coruscant, in the galaxy's ultimate big city. And as she gazed out the window, she realized that she really didn't care. Keying the blinds closed, she turned her back on the distant horizon and got back to work. The next few months were an unpleasant mix of frantic work, irritating dealings with the locals, and unrelenting tedium. Lothal was exactly as Arinda remembered it, filled with backwoods humans, even more backwoods non-humans, patterns of cronyism that often undercut the imperial interests on the planet, and a social structure that provided no quality entertainment whatsoever. The cronyism was the worst part. During her years away in the capital, the Empire had steadily built up Lothal's industries, expanded the mines, and gradually brought in more troops to oversee it all. But not everyone was happy with the planet's new direction. The old leaders and families resented the slow erosion of their power, and they weren't quiet about lining up their friends, associates, and everyone else within their web of influence to denounce the new order.
The imperial response had been predictable. Repression of speech and curtailment of freedoms, followed by business as usual. Part of that business involved moving farmers off their land, sometimes to establish a new factory or military facility, more often to enhance mining operations. Naturally, the farmers complained about the forced relocation and drew their friends into the quarrel, occasionally to the point of violence. It was a pointless argument. Lothal had more than enough cropland for its purposes, and in fact was still a net exporter of foodstuffs. The relative handful of lost farms was negligible. But the displaced farmers seldom saw it that way, and the offer of jobs in factories or mines was usually rejected out of hand. Still, despite the complaints of a small minority, the work continued to progress. Those who had claimed that the new development would create jobs and prosperity were vindicated. Those who had decried the heightened imperial presence and preached doom were reduced to quiet muttering. But not all the threats were internal. Arinda had been on Lothal 3 months when an unexpected danger quietly reared its head.
"Yes, Your Excellency. I noticed this report a few days ago,"
Minister Tua said, frowning in confusion at the page Arinda had pulled up on her computer.
"I don't see why it's a problem."
"Don't you?"
Arinda said darkly. For all Tua's expertise at managing Lothal's industrial infrastructure, the woman was utterly blind in certain matters.
"The governor of Kintoni is offering to expand her military-grade landing and maintenance facilities, and you don't see why that's a problem?"
"No, Your Excellency,"
Tua said, looking more confused than ever.
"I would think the more naval presence we have in the area, the better. With all the pirates and smugglers..."
"We don't want enhanced naval presence in this area,"
Arinda ground out.
Did the woman understand nothing?
"We want an enhanced naval presence on Lothal. Do you understand? Only on Lothal."
Tua shrank back into her chair, her eyes wide with surprise and fear. "Good."
"Your Excellency, we want Lothal to be the center of this part of the Outer Rim,"
Arinda said quietly. Somehow the softer tone seemed to frighten Tua more than the outburst had.
"That means industry, mining, commerce, expanded youth and military academies, and a powerful navy presence to maintain it all.
If Kintoni starts drawing away our ships, everything else will follow."
She raised her eyebrows.
"Do you want to live on Lothal the way it was, Minister Tua? Or do you even remember that far back?"
With a visible effort, Tua found her voice.
"I understand, Your Excellency, but..."
"But you don't see what we can do about it,"
Arinda said, suddenly disgusted. All of Tua's off-world schooling, and yet here she was, drifting back to thinking like a native. That is, barely at all.
"I'm leaving immediately for Coruscant,"
she said, blanking the display and standing up. So much for settling in permanently.
"You'll be in charge until I return."
"Yes, Your Excellency,"
Tua said, belatedly getting to her feet.
May I ask how long you'll be gone?"
"Until I finish this,"
Arinda said.
"One way or another."
"I'm sorry, but Grand Moff Tarkin isn't on Coruscant at the moment,"
the receptionist at Tarkin's office said, her voice polite but vacant.
"If you wish, I could send him a message."
"No need,"
Arinda said. She hadn't really expected Tarkin to be here, but it had been worth a try.
"Just add a note to whatever you next send him that Governor Arinda Price of Lothal sends her greetings."
"Yes, Governor."
So she didn't recognize Arinda either by face or by name. Not surprising, really.
There were thousands of governors in the empire, and no one could be expected to memorize even a tenth of them. Still, Arinda had hoped. The airspeeder's holocom was blinking a waiting call when she returned. She glanced at the ID, smiled to herself, and keyed it.
"This is Governor Arinda Price."
She identified herself to the uniformed man who answered.
"I'm returning a call from Commodore Thrawn."
"One moment, Governor."
The display blanked. A minute later, Thrawn's familiar blue face and red eyes appeared.
"Ms. Price,"
Thrawn said, inclining his head toward her in greeting.
"Rather, I should say, Governor Price."
"Thank you for returning my call, Commodore,"
Arinda said, deciding not to make an issue of the slip. She was familiar enough with Thrawn's lack of grace in social and political matters to know it hadn't been a deliberate insult. Besides, it was never a good idea to berate someone who was, hopefully, about to be useful.
"Have you had a chance to look over the proposals I sent you?"
"I have,"
Thrawn said, lowering his eyes to something off-screen.
"If I understand correctly, you want my opinion as to whether Lothal or Kintoni would be the better location for an expansion of the Navy's presence in that part of the Outer Rim."
"That's correct,"
Arinda said, mentally crossing her fingers. Against her natural instincts, she discarded her original plan to subtly weigh the data and proposals in Lothal's favor. Thrawn might detect such manipulation, and that would be the end of any chance to get him on her side.
"Obviously, I have an interest in this matter, but I tried to present the choice in as fair a manner as possible."
"And so you did, Governor,"
Thrawn acknowledged, his eyes still focused off-screen.
"I took the liberty of confirming your notes and maps through the Navy archives. Your presentation was remarkably even-handed."
"Thank you,"
Arinda said, feeling a shiver run up her back. Just as well she hadn't tried to slant it.
"Your conclusion?"
"Both systems offer advantages,"
Thrawn said, finally looking back up at her.
"But if I had to choose one, I would choose Lothal."
Arinda exhaled silently.
"Thank you, Commodore," she said. "May I quote you when I make my presentation to the High Command?"
"No need, Governor,"
Thrawn said.
"I have worked up a full analysis that includes my conclusions. I can send it to you now, if you like."
"I would indeed," Arinda said. "Thank you."
"No thanks needed,"
he assured her.
"I always stand ready to assist the Imperial Navy in any way I can. Is there anything more?"
"Not at this time, Commodore," she said. "Hopefully we'll cross paths again soon. Goodbye."
"Goodbye, Governor."
It took a few moments for the report to load. First to her airspeeder, and then to a data card. Arinda watched the progress, running it all through her mind. With Thrawn's blessing in hand, there was only one person yet she needed to see before she would be ready to take her case to the High Command. And there was a reason she'd put this contact last on her list. Securing the data card in her pocket, she took a moment to mentally prepare herself. Then, joining the traffic flow, she headed across the center of the Federal District toward a familiar, a far too familiar place. The office of Senator Domus Rankin.
"I hardly expected to see you here today,"
Rankin commented stiffly as he ushered Arinda to a chair. Still seething over his loss of Price Mining, Arinda guessed, but still not ready to try a countermove against her.
"I heard you were on Coruscant, but assumed you'd be spending your time with all those powerful friends and patrons you once threatened me with."
"Social calls can wait,"
Arinda said, pulling out a data card.
I presume you've heard about Kintoni's request for a larger Navy presence in their system?
Of course,
Ranking said, frowning as he sat down behind his desk.
So?
So, even the Navy hasn't got infinite resources,
Arinda said as patiently as she could.
She should have guessed Ranking would be so focused on his petty political intrigues that he would miss the full significance of Sans's power play. So every credit they spend on Kintoni is a credit they don't spend on Lothal. So we have to put a stop to it.
All right, fine, he said. Points well taken. I presume you have some ideas?
Of course, Arinda said. The plan is threefold. First, I have a proposal showing what Lothal could do in the way of landing and maintenance facilities. Here are the details.
She handed him a data card.
Second, I have an analysis and recommendation for Lothal from Commodore Thrawn. Third...
Thrawn?
Ranking cut in, frowning again.
That blue-skinned lieutenant we met at that Ascension Week party?
Yes.
Only he's a Commodore now, Arinda said. And is highly respected by the High Command. His opinion ought to carry significant weight. And third...
She raised her eyebrows.
I want you to work on Governor Sans.
Work on her how?
I don't know,
Arinda said impatiently.
Talk to her, argue with her, persuade her. However you want to do it is up to you. Just get her to withdraw her proposal.
I can try, Ranking said. How long do I have?
The presentations will be heard 6 days from now, she said. I'm going to spend that time fine-tuning my proposal and looking for allies in the Senate. I suggest you spend that time working on Sans.
Got it, Ranking said. However I want to do it.
Arinda lifted a hand.
Just do what you do best, Senator. Do what you do best.
All rise,
the warrant officer standing beside the short table intoned. Seated among the crowd, in the petitioner's gallery, Arinda stood up. Ranking beside her, as an officer and two civilians filed into the room. Across the narrow aisle, she spotted Governor Sans, as she rose with the rest of the people on her side of the gallery. Sans's back, it seemed to her, looked unnaturally stiff. The board took their seats, and as the petitioners sat down, the civilian in the middle picked up the datapad lying on the table in front of her.
The Select Committee of the Imperial High Command has studied the various proposals that have been brought before it,
she said.
We are here to make their decisions known.
She tapped the datapad.
First, in the matter of Lothal versus Kintoni regarding a contract for the expansion of Navy facilities, the contract is awarded to Lothal.
Arinda felt a flood of relief wash over her. She glanced across the aisle, and it seemed to her that some of Sans's stiffness drained away. Odd, given that her bid had just been turned down. Perhaps she hadn't wanted the contract as much as she'd let on.
We can go now,
Ranking prompted quietly, tapping her sleeve.
Go ahead,
Arinda murmured back, studying her datapad.
The next few petitions are also Outer Rim matters. I'd like to see how those go down.
Ranking grunted.
Fine,
he said, and lapsed into sullen silence. Arinda had been keeping an eye on the various petitions, and none of the board's decisions came as a surprise. Finally, after 20 minutes, she nodded and gestured Ranking to the aisle. He stood up and slipped past the rest of the people in their row, Arinda right behind him.
That worked out well,
Ranking commented as they left the audience room and headed toward the building's exit.
I suppose congratulations are in order.
Thank you,
Arinda said. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw a woman in a white ISB tunic angling across the entryway toward them.
But we couldn't have done it without you.
I'm glad I could do my part.
Senator Doom is ranking,
the woman said. Ranking turned to her, giving a small twitch as he spotted the uniform.
Yes,
he said cautiously.
Major Hartell, ISB,
the woman identified herself.
I need you to come with me, sir.
What for?
Ranking asked, his face starting to darken.
What's this about?
Passers-by were beginning to pause and slow down, Arinda noted peripherally, and heads were starting to turn.
Do you really want to have that discussion here, Senator?
Hartell asked.
I'll tell you what I don't want,
Ranking countered, his voice starting to rise.
I don't want some ISB flunky throwing my name on a list just so some other ISB flunky can play power games with the Imperial Senate. I demand to know the charge, if there even is one, and who the claimant is.
As you wish, Senator, Hartell said. The claimant in this case is the Imperial Security Bureau itself. The charge is bribery.
Ranking caught his breath.
What?
He asked, the words coming out from between stiff lips.
Don't act so surprised, Hartell said. 4 days ago, you approached Governor Sands of Kintoni, offering a substantial bribe if she would withdraw her planet's petition before the High Command. Governor Sands declined on the grounds that a withdrawal at this late date would look suspicious, but then agreed to your counter-proposal that she deliberately sabotage her presentation, with double the original bribe to be paid if Lothal won the bid.
Ranking had taken on the look of a hunted animal.
That's a lie,
he insisted.
All of it!
But to Arinda, his tone sounded more worried than defiant.
Whatever Sands told you...
Governor Sands hasn't told us anything, Hartell said evenly. But she will. She's already in custody for her part in this conspiracy.
Ranking caught his breath, twisting his head to look at Arinda.
Price!
You really shouldn't discuss criminal acts with someone else's data card in your card pouch,
Arinda said calmly.
But...
Ranking shot a look at Hartell, looked back at Arinda.
You told me to do it!
I told you to talk, argue, or persuade her,
Arinda corrected.
I never suggested or even hinted you try to bribe her.
She gestured at Hartell.
All of which is also on the recording.
Indeed, Hartell said. Thank you for your assistance, Governor Price. You may go. Senator Ranking, follow me, please.
Ranking gave Arinda one final look, his expression a mix of disbelief and hatred. Then, without a word, he turned and followed Hartell out. All around them, with the drama now over, the people of Coruscant resumed their activities.
I'll be leaving for Lothal in the morning,
Arinda told the receptionist at her Coruscant office as she gathered the data card she'd forgotten to pick up earlier that day.
I shouldn't be gone long, though. There are a few meetings and conferences next month I'll want to attend. Grand Moff Tarkin has invited me to visit Iriadu, and I'll certainly want to be back for Ascension Week. So you might as well keep everything open and running.
Yes, Governor,
the receptionist said.
Oh, and you got another message about 2 hours ago from a Juihir Madras.
Arinda froze.
Juihir Madras?
Yes, Governor, from the Uvo IV Detention Center. She's written, about 20 of these messages over the past year or so. I send them on, but your Lothal office always turns them back. Do you want to take them with you now?
Arinda took a deep breath. Juihir Madras. Her old friend. Her old traitorous friend.
No. Keep them here, she said. I'll let you know when I'm ready to read them.
Chapter 22
The soldier in the field and the crew member aboard a warship inevitably see a war from a limited perspective. Their goal is to carry out their mission or their appointed task, and trust that their commanders are aware of the larger situation and the vast matrix of facts, positions, options, and dangers. Leadership is a role and a task that should never be aspired to lightly. Neither should loyalty be given without reason, even if the primary reason is nothing more than the soldier's oath and duty. A true leader will work to prove worthy of a deeper trust. But leadership and loyalty are both two-bladed weapons. Each can be twisted from its intended purpose. The consequences are never pleasant.
Persuade them if you can,
Fleet Admiral Jock Danasius said, his face on the hollow grim and angry.
Devastate them if you have to, but stop them one way or another, and stop them fast.
Understood, Fleet Admiral,
Thrawn said, his voice steady and cool. A lot steadier, Eli thought, and a lot cooler than he himself was feeling right now. And from the expressions he could see on the rest of the Chimera's bridge crew, he wasn't alone in his misgivings. Small wonder. It hadn't been all that long since the Separatist crisis sparked the bloody devastation of the Clone Wars. Billions had died in that conflict, with hundreds of planets all but destroyed, and thousands more still clawing their way up from the brink. The last thing the galaxy could afford was a repeat of that horror. But Governor Kessel and the people of Bodajeff were apparently ready to give it a try. Thrawn and Danasius finished their conversation, and the hollow blanked. For a moment, Thrawn continued to gaze at the empty projector, as if pondering the orders he'd just received. Then, lifting his head a few centimeters, he turned to face his senior officers.
Commander Feyre, instruct the helm to lay in a course for Bodajeff, he ordered.
Yes, sir!
Feyre looked over at the helmsman, who was, Eli noted, already watching her closely, and lifted a finger. The helmsman nodded back and turned to his board.
On course for Bodajeff, Commodore,
Feyre confirmed.
Thank you.
Thrawn looked around the group.
Comments? Senior Lieutenant Pyrondi.
With all due respect, sir, I think they're crazy,
Weapons Officer Pyrondi said, a bit hesitantly. As the newest addition to the Chimera's Bridge Officer Corps, she was still getting used to Thrawn's unique style of open tactical consultation.
Do they really think they can secede from the Empire all by themselves?
Who says they are all by themselves?
Feyre countered soberly.
There's a lot of unrest out there in the galaxy, and it's growing.
Though it's mostly just grumbling, Eli said.
So far,
Feyre said pointedly.
But who's to say Kessel hasn't got 100 other systems quietly backing him, all of them just waiting to see how far he gets before making independence proclamations of their own?
Not far is exactly where he's going to get,
Pyrondi said.
I mean, seriously, ma'am. We've got enough firepower here to carve our initials into Bodajeff's bedrock.
A fact Governor Kessel is undoubtedly aware of, Thrawn said. What then does he hope to gain by his words of defiance?
That's the question, sir,
Feyre agreed.
If he's the representative for a lot of other systems, just slapping him down won't necessarily solve the problem. It might even exacerbate it. If he's alone,
she gestured to Pyrondi.
Then Lieutenant Pyrondi is very likely right. The man is crazy.
Though if he is, he's picked a great place to show it off,
Pyrondi said.
I've met a few Jeffies in my life. They're the best followers in the world. You persuade them they're your leader, and they'll follow you anywhere. And even with all the immigration over the past century, they're still a solid 85% of the planetary population.
Yet they didn't complain about Coruscant appointing a human governor over them? Eli asked.
Like I said, sir, they're followers,
Pyrondi said.
Prove you're a leader, and they're there. Kessel must have proved it, and then some.
That is my reading of the Jeffies as well,
Thrawn agreed.
Which suggests that the best strategy may be to create a new leader for them.
Assuming they're just blindly following Kessel, sir, and haven't bought into this secession thing themselves,
Pyrondi warned.
You get a group of Jeffy true believers, and they may not need a leader to tell them what to do. There's a lot we don't know about them.
Then we should learn,
Thrawn said.
Commander Pharaoh, how long until we reach Protojeff?
Pharaoh checked her datapad.
Approximately 15 hours, sir.
I'll be in my quarters, Thrawn said. You have the bridge, Commander Pharaoh. I want the Chimera fully ready for combat 14 hours from now.
It will be, Commodore,
Pharaoh said grimly. And in her eyes, Eli could see the flickering, burning memories of her own Clone Wars experiences.
Count on it.
The history of Botajeff was one of long periods of passive allegiance, followed by brief episodes of often fiery conflict, followed by new leadership and another era of passive allegiance. Jeffy art followed that same pattern. Curves interrupted by stark lines or sharp angles, with a color palette mirroring the group emotional and ethical spectrum. Sculpts were low contrast, perhaps indicating that the Jeffies themselves recognized the shortcomings in their cultural matrix. In contrast, the hanging trestles, with their quick dampening balances, indicated they also recognized the basic stability of their political system.
Commodore? Vanto's voice came. Enter!
Vanto crossed the floor, passing through the holograms.
Jeffy Art?
Yes.
Nice,
Vanto said, his gaze moving between the pieces.
A bit jagged for my taste, but nice.
I came to inform you, Commodore, that we're 2 hours from Botajeff, and the Chimera is ready for battle.
Thank you, Commander, Thrawn said. You seem troubled. Are you concerned about the upcoming confrontation?
I am,
Vanto said. But probably not in the way everyone else is. I'm concerned that we were given this assignment because certain people are trying to set you up.
Have you any evidence for this?
No evidence, but plenty of logic,
Vanto said.
We know there are government officials who don't like you, many of whom also dislike non-humans in general. So now we have a largely non-human world proclaiming independence, with a hefty system defense fleet to back it up. The two most likely outcomes are, first, that you'll stomp the Jeffies into the dirt, or second, that the Botajeff Defense Force will overwhelm us and chase us out of the system.
Fortunately, there are more than just those options.
I hope so,
Vanto said. Because in my first scenario, Coruscant can paint you as the mad alien run amok, who stomped a world of innocent Jeffies and humans who were just obeying their appointed leader. In the second scenario, you get painted as incompetent, and they kick you down to commanding an ore carrier.
Interesting that you should choose that example,
Thrawn said. The Jeffy art hollows vanished, replaced by a map of the Empire.
Do you recall the position Captain Filia Rossi held before commanding the Blood Crow?
First officer on an ore freighter escort, wasn't it?
Yes, Thrawn said. I'm aware that you and some of the others had reservations at the time about her capability and seniority. But consider what we now know about how Dunium and other metals are being taken from the general market. It may be that the ore freighters she was escorting were more important than anyone knew at the time.
Interesting,
Vanto said thoughtfully.
Not just that, but I seem to recall now that her previous posting was to Socorro.
Lots of Dunium in the asteroid belts there.
I wonder.
As you say, no one knew what those freighters meant.
I wonder if that could have led to someone being a little less careful with security than they are now.
Indeed, Thrawn said. In which case, it should be possible to track the shipments and discover where this operation is occurring.
I can try. Banto frowned as the word caught his attention. Operation Singular? You think this is a single project?
I do, Thrawn said. Consider. Hyperdrive components are being taken from supply depots, but no assembled hyperdrives are disappearing. Sublight engine components are likewise being taken, but no completed engines.
Interesting, Banto said slowly. Though that could just mean they don't want to lug around things that are that bulky.
Perhaps, Thrawn said. Though there are certainly transports large enough to carry such items. My conclusion is that they may be creating hyperdrives and sublight engines of a size never before seen.
Banto's eyes widen in shock.
You're saying something bigger even than a Star Destroyer?
From my reading of the data, considerably larger, Thrawn said. I confess I feel a certain foreboding at that conclusion. I have seen this same Omseki syndrome. I've seen this syndrome before, Thrawn continued. Star Destroyer-sized capital ships and large numbers of supporting starfighters are the most efficient and flexible naval array for both deterrent and combat. Yet there are many who consider larger to be the equivalent of better. Even the Empire has limited resources, and I fear that those resources are not always allocated wisely.
The realities of a large bureaucracy, Banto said ruefully. Two bureaucracies in this case, if you count both the government and the Navy. There are always boondoggles. Sometimes really big ones that slip through the cracks of the review process.
That is unfortunately true, Thrawn said. Perhaps I will yet have an opportunity to express my thoughts on the strategies of such large-scale weapon systems.
Well, you get invited to Coruscant often enough, Banto pointed out. Maybe, he trailed off, suddenly understanding.
You know where it is, don't you? You figured out where they're building this monstrosity.
I have an idea.
I should have guessed you would, Banto said. I take it you've checked Rossi's ore freighters?
I was unable to discover their final destination, Thrawn said. However, I did find the most likely vector for the shipments.
Which only gives you... Banto smiled with fresh understanding.
But we also have the likely vector for that Wookiee slave ship.
So assuming they were all headed to the same place, you crossed the vectors?
And found a location, Thrawn said. It may not be the correct location, of course. Perhaps an opportunity to visit will present itself at some point. In the meantime, we have Bertichev to deal with.
Yes, Banto said. I presume you have a plan?
I do.
The galactic map disappeared, replaced by the image of a human standing behind a podium.
This is the recording of Governor Kessel's Declaration of Independence 30 hours ago.
Yes, I've seen it, Banto said.
Speech-wise, the man really lights up a room. Did you notice the artwork hanging on the display wall behind him?
All 57 pieces of it. Banto smiled wryly. Yes, I counted them. I also made hollows of every piece visible on that recording, in case you wanted to see what you could pull out about the man.
Thank you, Thrawn said. However, it won't tell us anything about the governor. The artwork has been collected over the centuries by the Jeffy people, and neither the pieces nor the placement have been altered by Governor Kessel.
Which you know because you've already checked the older archives, Banto said, a bit crestfallen.
Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. It was an excellent idea, Thrawn said. In other circumstances, it might well have been highly useful. But I draw your attention to the governor's words and speaking manner. What do you hear?
Well, he's not shy about his goals or feelings, Vanto said. Makes it very clear he has no intention of keeping Bodajeff in the Empire.
Yet should he not also show some recognition of the power that will surely be brought to bear against him?
One would certainly think so, Vanto said, rubbing his chin in concentration.
Now that you mention it, he's almost daring Coruscant to come in and stop him. I make a prediction, Thrawn said. I believe that upon our arrival, we will find heavy weaponry situated around the main governmental building. I also predict that Governor Kessel will repeat his challenge directly to the Chimera.
Really? Vanto said.
And the Planetary Defense Forces?
He will initially deploy them to keep the Chimera at a distance. At some later point, they will be sent to the attack.
Interesting tactics, Vanto said.
We'll find out soon enough.
Indeed, Thrawn said. You may return to the bridge now. When you arrive, have Starfighter Commander Yeev and Stormtrooper Commander Ayer report to me here. I have some final orders for them.
The Chimera reached Bodajeff exactly on schedule. And damned if Thrawn hadn't been right.
Two CR-90 Corvettes rising from orbit, Eli reported, running a quick eye over the tactical readout. Coming in from starboard and port, possibly trying to flank us, but keeping out of effective firing range. Five squadrons of V-19 Torrent interceptors rising from the North Polar base. Two more squadrons coming from South Polar.
Both Corvette's weapon systems are running cold, Pharaoh added. We may have taken them by surprise.
Reading three ground-based turbolaser clusters, Eli said, smiling to himself. Coordinates on tactical. Note that one of them is in the capital. Five turbolasers grouped around the governor's palace.
Around the palace? Pharaoh echoed disbelievingly. He's really counting on Imperial self-restraint, isn't he?
Eli thought back to the battle over Umbara, and the pinpoint fire the Thunder Wasp had later delivered to the pre-spice vein on Sifar.
More likely he doesn't understand Imperial gunner accuracy, ma'am.
Perhaps we will have the opportunity to instruct him, Thrawn said. Senior Lieutenant Yeev, launch Ties.
Ties launching, Commodore,
Yeev acknowledged.
Targets?
Send four each to the Corvettes, Thrawn ordered. They are not to fire, but are to perform close-line flybys. Two each starboard and port side. The other Ties will move to form a screen between us and the V-19s.
Including the special unit, sir?
Yes, Thrawn said. They are not to fire until and unless I so order.
Yes, sir.
Yeev turned to her board. Eli frowned. He hadn't heard anything about a special Tie unit. Something Thrawn and Yeev had cooked up after he left Thrawn's quarters for the bridge?
You're not letting the Ties defend themselves, sir?
Pharaoh asked.
I'm offering the Jeffies one free shot, Commander, Thrawn replied calmly. That said, I do not believe they will make the first attack.
Commodore, we're getting a signal from Governor Kessel, Lomar called.
Put it through.
The comm display lit up with the same wizened, scowly face Eli had seen on the previous recording. Kessel was standing closer to the cam this time, and up close, he looked even more unpleasant and shifty.
This is Governor Kessel of the Free System of Bodajeff,
he intoned.
You have intruded into Jeffy's space. If you do not leave, you will be fired upon.
This is Commodore Thrawn, commander of the Imperial Star Destroyer Chimera, Thrawn said. I am afraid you are acting under a misapprehension, Governor. According to the treaty signed by the Jeffys after the Clone War, any change in status must follow the formal rules called for in Section 18, Paragraph 4.
The wizened face drew back from the cam, and Eli caught a glimpse of the artwork hanging on the wall behind him.
What are you talking about? There is no such treaty!
On the tactical, the four TIE fighters swept past the starboard corvette, as Thrawn had ordered. Eli held his breath, wondering if the corvette would see it as an attack and open fire. Fortunately, it didn't. Aside from a brief twitch of its bow, in fact, it made no response at all. The portside corvette was even more sanguine in the case of its starfighter flyby, without even that small reflexive twitch.
Your lack of knowledge regarding your assigned post is puzzling, Thrawn said. Under the circumstances, I must draw your attention to paragraph 7. That proviso states that before any talks may be opened, the governor or other leader must fully disarm.
He gestured toward the tactical.
I must therefore insist that those turbolaser emplacements around your palace be removed.
Oh, you insist, do you?
Kessel retorted in a condescending tone.
So, Commodore or not, Imperial Star Destroyer or not, you still dare not face a free people and their weapons? Afraid our bite is as bad as our bark?
He folded his arms across his chest, a mocking smile on his face.
You want those turbo lasers gone, Commodore Thrawn? Fine. Do it yourself!
Very well,
Thrawn said. He gestured to Yeev.
Senior Lieutenant?
Yes, sir,
Yeev said.
Special Unit 1, go!
On the tactical, six of the TIE fighters that had been moving to intercept the V-19s abruptly broke formation. Weaving easily through the defenders' formation, they headed straight in toward the capital and the palace.
What? No!
Kessel shouted.
Defenders, defend!
The turbo lasers opened fire, their brilliant blasts sizzling through the air toward the incoming fighters. It was an exercise in futility. Yeev had trained her TIE pilots superbly, and the starfighters themselves were fast and nimble. They evaded the blast with ease, approaching the palace even as the defenders' fire increased.
It is not too late to surrender, Governor,
Thrawn said.
Never!
Kessel spat. His face was taut with expectation. His eyes focused somewhere off cam.
I will die with dignity and grace, and with the full strength and defiance of the Jeffy people at my side.
Your spirit is admirable, Thrawn said. But your dramatics are quite unnecessary. Observe the power and the skill of the Imperial Navy.
The TIEs had reached the palace, and their laser cannons opened fire. But they weren't targeting the palace. Even as they twisted and turned and jinked to avoid the frantic turbo laser blasts, they instead poured salvo after salvo into the weapons themselves. One of the turbo lasers disintegrated in a brilliant blast of shattered metal and ceramic. The second went, then the third.
Commander Pharaoh,
Thrawn called. Eli blinked. So engrossed had he become in the deadly dance at the planet's surface that he'd forgotten to keep track of the situation in the Chimera's immediate vicinity. He looked at the tactical to discover that, while he'd been distracted, the Chimera had somehow drifted a significant distance to starboard toward the corvette still holding position there. A blue line appeared on the tactical, marking the activation of one of the Star Destroyer's tractor beams. And on the comm display, Kessel gasped as his image gave a violent jerk. Eli looked back at the tactical as it belatedly hit him. He's on the corvette?
Indeed,
Thrawn said, the faintest hint of satisfaction in his voice.
Along with the extremely valuable art collection that you see behind him. My apologies, Governor, for failing to cooperate in your hoped-for destruction of the palace. It would have rather effectively covered up your theft, as well as enraging the Jeffies into launching a full attack on the Chimera. I expect you hope to slip away to freedom during the resulting chaos.
On the display, Kessel was breathing heavily, his face a mask of hatred and despair.
They'll never believe you,
he bit out.
The Jeffies are loyal to me.
They are loyal to a respected leader,
Thrawn countered, his voice going cold.
I do not believe they will see you as such beyond this day.
For a moment, Kessel glared. Then he seemed to wilt. Offering Thrawn another mocking smile, he half-turned to look at the wall behind him.
They're worth hundreds of millions, Commodore. Maybe even billions. And all they do is sit collecting dust in a third-rate building on a fifth-rate world. Billions!
He turned back, some of the melancholy replaced by puzzlement.
But there are two identical corvettes. How did you know I was on this one?
The starfighter flyby, Thrawn said. Your pilot twitched with reaction to what he feared would be an impending collision. Human crew. The other corvette trusted their leader implicitly, and thus showed no such fear. Jeffy crew. You, of course, could not rely on Jeffies to assist you in their betrayal.
Kessel sighed.
So that's it?
Hardly, Thrawn assured him. You and your crew must still be brought aboard the Chimera. The artwork must be returned. The Jeffies need to be enlightened, and a new leader must be chosen until Coruscant can send a new governor. His eyes glittered. Later, of course, there will be your trial.
He let the last word hang in the air for a moment, perhaps inviting Kessel the chance to respond. But the governor remained silent. Thrawn gestured for the comm display to be blanked.
So I gather there is no Clone Wars era treaty? Pharaoh asked.
No, Thrawn said. I merely wish to keep him in view until his movement under the tractor beam's pull gave final confirmation of his presence.
He took a deep breath.
Senior Lieutenant Lomar, contact the chief of the Botajev Defense Force and explain the situation. I'm sure he'll want proof. You may invite him aboard at his convenience. Commander Pharaoh, bring the governor's corvette into the hangar bay. Major Ayer, your stormtroopers will board as soon as the vessel is secure. Take care with the prisoners. Take even better care with the artwork. Senior Lieutenant Yeev, bring Special Unit 1 back to screen position with the other TIEs. Inform all pilots there to remain alert, but that no further combat is anticipated.
He looked at Eli, and Eli thought he could detect a small smile on the Chiss's lips.
Commander Vonto, you will contact the High Command on Coruscant. Inform them that the situation on Botajev has been resolved.
Chapter 23.
It is believed by many that the military life is one of adventure and excitement. In truth, that life more often consists of long periods of routine, even boredom, with only brief intervals of challenge and danger. Enemies seldom seek out their opponents. The warrior must become a hunter, searching and stalking with craft and patience. Successes are often achieved by a confluence of small things, stray facts, unwary or overheard conversations, logistical vectors. If the hunter is persistent, the pattern will become visible, and the enemy will be found. Only then will the routine be broken by combat. It's not surprising, therefore, that those seeking excitement sometimes weary of long and arduous pursuits. They are relieved when the enemy appears of his own accord, standing firm and issuing a challenge. But the wise warrior is especially wary at those times. He knows there are few things more dangerous than a skilled enemy on his own carefully chosen ground.
Code cylinders, please,
the door warden said.
Her voice is brisk and formal, but her face shows suspicion.
Here, Vanto said, handing over both his cylinder and Thrawn's.
The warden takes the first and slips it into the ID reader. The confirmation procedure takes longer than usual. Perhaps she doesn't believe that the IDs are genuine. Vanto notices the delay as well.
Is there a problem, warrant officer?
No problem, Commander.
Her face still holds suspicion as she returns the cylinders. But she does not hold enough doubt to summon assistance.
You're cleared to enter, Commander Vanto.
Another brief but noticeable hesitation.
As are you, Admiral Thrawn.
They pass through the doorway into the High Command headquarters.
I wonder what it is this time,
Vanto murmured as they made their way among the other Navy personnel, hurrying about their appointed tasks.
The pattern of communications during the past 4 days indicates that the 103rd and the 125th task forces have also been summoned,
Thrawn said.
I conclude a major mission is being planned.
Interesting, Vanto said.
How much sifting through the chatter did it take to dig out those bits of information?
Not much, Thrawn assured him.
There are patterns in Imperial communications, as there are in everything else. Once the pattern is known, knowledge is easier to obtain.
That's quite a skill, Vanto said. It would take me hours with a computer and matrix sheet to get anywhere. The rest of the group was waiting, seated in a half circle in front of a holo projector, with their backs to the newcomers as Thrawn and Vanto arrived. 4 of those in attendance were Navy officers, and 4 were civilians. The latter dressed in upper-class governmental style. There were 2 empty seats between the officers and the civilians. Standing at one side of the projector was Fleet Admiral Danasius.
His expression is controlled, but his body stance holds tension.
Standing at the opposite side was Colonel Yularen.
His face and stance also hold tension, though he conceals it better than Danasius.
Admiral Thrawn,
Danasius said, nodding gravely in greeting as Thrawn and Vanto approached the ring of seats.
May I introduce Admiral Durrell of the ISD Judicator and the 103rd Task Force, Admiral Kinshara of the ISD Stalwart and the 125th, Admiral Thrawn of the ISD Chimera, recently assigned the 96th.
Honored,
Thrawn said, nodding greetings as he and Vanto passed the end of the row.
Kinshara returns the greeting politely, his expression holding no rancor or ill will. Durrell's expression and body stance hold displeasure at the presence of a non-human. The other 2 officers, one a captain, the other a commander, hold the normal courtesy and wariness of aides meeting an unknown flag officer for the first time.
And these are the governors of the relevant systems,
Danasius continued.
Governor Ristos of Baton, Governor Wistran of Tanash, Governor Eastorn of Salmon.
The 4th governor in the line is unexpected.
And Governor Price of Lothal.
Honored,
Thrawn repeated.
It is good to see you again, Governor Price.
Likewise,
Price said.
Her expression is cool, her voice professional, but her body stance holds a hidden tension.
I wish it could have been under more pleasant circumstances.
Circumstances you've been called upon to deal with,
Danasius said.
His voice holds grim concern.
Sit down, please, and we'll get right to it. Colonel Ularen?